We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Should Lando be worried about the 10-point gap to Oscar Piastri now?
Oscar's got that lead. He's worked hard for it. And I think it's giving him a confidence that, on the inside, he's a killer right now.
I'm wondering when the edge is going to appear.
They've still been quite nice. They're still good teammates. But it cannot go on.
Jolyon, we asked whether Max would change his approach a few times last year. Do you think the situation's different now?
You know, I still don't think he's going to change his approach. I still think he has one way of racing.
What he did with George was wrong, but equally that is part of who he is and why we love him.
But I see there's a difference between the racing Max Verstappen and that red mist moment.
If you take out the red mist element to Max's approach, you could alter him entirely.
George Russell started the Canadian Grand Prix last year from pole. Can they hope for something similar?
I can see it being their best race of the year.
What about Ferrari?
Hamilton is brilliant in Montreal, so this has got to be some sort of redemption circuit for Lewis, I think.
Aston are a team on the move, it feels.
What's going on with Lance, though?
Spain gave us Oscar Piastri's fifth win of 2025. Fernando Alonso's first points of the season, Sauber's best result in 3 years, and that dramatic collision between Max Verstappen and George Russell in the closing laps. So what does Montreal have in store for us? Welcome everyone to F1 Nation's preview of the Canadian Grand Prix. I'm Tom Clarkson, and joining me on the show is former Renault driver and F1 TV commentator Jolyon Palmer, and Sky Sports F1 presenter Natalie Pinkham. Great to have you both with us again. Pinks, how are things?
Yeah, really good, thanks. Good to hear your voices and see those faces again.
And Jolyon, are you a dad for the first time yet? What's going on there?
I'm not yet. So I thought
but
I've nicely timed it.
By the time the pod goes out.
It could be, yeah. I thought I timed it really well for the gap between Barcelona and Canada, but Canada's getting closer. And it still hasn't happened, so we'll see.
Can I just flag something, JP? You haven't timed anything, okay? This is not about you.
You're not saying this is my genius to plan it for a nice summer, week off, end of a triple header.
I mean, that would be, impressive, but out of your control, I'm afraid, on this one.
I'm realising that quickly.
Let's start with what we've learned from the European triple header. Because we had three different winners and lots of other big stories. Max Verstappen won in Imola, Lando Norris was victorious in Monaco, and Oscar Piastri took the checkered flag in Spain, securing an incredible eighth consecutive podium. And Oscar now leads Lando in the championship by 10 points, with Max 49 points behind, which is basically two race wins. So, Jolyon, what are your biggest takeaways from the triple header?
I think that it will be a McLaren title fight. And I think that was basically just Barcelona that really gave us that. I think there was a couple of things with that Spanish Grand Prix. Firstly, it was the race that everyone's been looking at for round nine and the flexi wing clamp down. And at the start of the season, everyone was saying, well, you know, people are going to have to make two cars, one for the first eight races and one from round nine onwards. And honestly, you're hard pushed to see any real difference in the pecking order. And I think that obviously favours McLaren. You know, they've had the best car. They're still 1-2 in the Drivers' Championship. And when you combine it with Max losing a heap of points as well, it now looks like it's one of them. And neither of them have been champions before. So, you know, it's still a great fight. And now I think we can definitely call it intra-team.
I wasn't in Barcelona, but I was there for Imola and Monaco. And I tell you, just maybe think of our last conversation, actually, about Lando's approach. And I've just noticed a slight shift from him. And it was in the pen after Monaco qualifying. And most drivers, when they put it on pole for Monaco, are punching the air because, barring a disaster, you can convert that into a win. He was much more measured than I've ever known him. And I said, whoa, 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 hang on a minute. You're not even celebrating. He said, no, no. It felt as if this is something that he conclusion he's reached on his own or a conversation within the team, but not to give too much away to the media, to the fans, and perhaps just be slightly more measured in his approach. And I thought it was really interesting because it felt like almost a tightening up. And then he was able to go out the next day and deliver. And that's obviously when the points came and he got his maiden Monaco Grand Prix victory. And then he celebrated. I don't know, it was a subtle change, but I thought a significant one.
Yeah, I saw it too. And do you agree with Jolyon that it's now an intra-team battle for the world championship? Or do you think Max Verstappen can recover from this?
I still don't rule Max out of this. I mean, he hasn't he? He's saying, well, you know, I don't even know if it was on the cards, but I think he's playing that down. I think come December, he will be frustrated if he isn't the champion, because I still think if anyone can, Max can.
I think it's intra-team now. I think the McLaren advantage was bigger than it's been all season in Barcelona. That was the biggest pole margin we've seen. And, you know, what was interesting after the race for me is that Oscar Piastri bounced back from the disappointment of Monaco, delivered an exceptional weekend. I think his best weekend in Formula One to date. And Lando Norris was still very measured, just to pick up on what you were saying earlier, Pinks. And I'm wondering when the edge is going to appear. I want to see an edge between these two. I thought maybe after qualifying that the first shots had been fired when Lando tried to sneak a toe from Oscar on that first run of Q3. Andrea Stella, team principal, denied it, said it was, to quote him, a minor episode. Did either of you think shots were being fired during quali?
I thought it was the first sign of them playing against each other. And when, you know, Oscar came on the radio and said cheeky, and just immediately, he knew what was going on, didn't he? And he went to the inside and hit the brakes hard to give his teammate absolutely nothing. And it was the first time that, you know, they're actively trying to hinder one another, really. I mean, of course, it made sense for Oscar to do that. I kind of agree overall. They've still been quite nice. They're still good teammates, but it cannot go on. When now that, you know, in my belief, it's one of them will be champion. They have to start withholding a bit of info from the other, making sure that when it all comes down on Saturday, they have the last tenth in the bag, and they're not showing maybe all their hand on a Friday, and they are getting their elbows out more with each other on a Sunday. They can't go on being nice. And I think Saturday at Barca was the sign of Lando trying to do something a little bit cheeky.
I don't know, though. I think this is uncharted territory for us as fans watching the narrative sort of evolve between the two of them, because Oscar is just a different type of driver. He doesn't fall out publicly anyway with those around him, or at least not from what we've seen through previous titles that he's secured. He just doesn't give anything away. I mean, you might see changes in Lando's behaviour, which is what I noticed in Monaco. But I just think Oscar is, he just plays it so cool. And we talked about this before, whether he's winning or losing, he gives nothing away to his opposition. I think that's his trump card.
Pinks, that's off track, and I agree with you. But I'm talking on track. I want to see the fireworks on track and just compare and contrast with the other intra-team battles we've had in recent years. I'm thinking Hamilton, Rosberg, Vettel, Webber. I mean, Pinks, you were there for all of it.
Yeah, but you saw that all off track as well. They're just very different personalities.
But we did see it on track. That's the key point, right? We didn't see it off. We didn't see it off track until Turkey 2010 between Webber and Vettel. That's when it became an off-track conversation. Prior to Turkey 2010, when they crashed into each other, it was all pretty civil. And then it all went wrong. And I'm still waiting for that moment between these two.
With your popcorn.
Yeah.
On the edge of your seat.
It has to come, right? They're fighting for a title. They're fighting for McLaren supremacy, if not the title. But it's a Formula One World Championship. Neither of them have won one. They're both desperate to show that they're still the main man for McLaren. That they want to be. This is what you start doing Formula One for. This is what you start doing go-karting for, to be a Formula One world champion. And they have gilt-edged chances this year. They have a teammate that is, they are so evenly matched that I don't see this being a Hamilton Bottas where, well, you know, they're slightly close, or even a Verstappen Perez, you know, for a few races they're close and then the champion becomes the champion by, you know, five races to go. This it has to go down to the wire with how closely matched they are. And it can't be friendly the whole way through.
Yeah, and you're right, because this could be their only chance. With the reg changes next year, the other teams could come into play and suddenly McLaren are back in the pack.
And should Lando be worried about the 10-point gap to Oscar Piastri now? That's a margin that Oscar can start playing with now.
I suppose after the win in Monaco, you would hope, if you were in Lando's camp, that it would be a tighter margin, or in fact, a lead for Lando. That's the thing, isn't it, is that even when Lando's been doing well, so has Oscar. He's tucked in just behind him. So he's scooping up vital points all the time. And I thought it was interesting, actually, how Lando spoke to the press about the fact that it is all about accumulating points and just gathering as much as you can to take the title at the end of the year.
So I think there's a massive, from the title battles that I've been in junior formula, if you're in the championship lead, no matter really how slender, you can have that little bit more confidence because you know on a bad weekend, you're still going to be in the fight. For Lando being 10 points down, if he doesn't score in Canada and Oscar wins, and this can happen any race, you know, it can be someone else wipes you out, it can be a mechanical, it could be something well out of your control, suddenly the gap is 35 points and the whole narrative changes. And I always found it a big thing to be within striking distance. And if you're in the lead, you know, no matter what happens at the end of the weekend, you'll turn up to the next one and there's still, you're in the championship battle. And as soon as you're beyond 25 points, suddenly you're clinging on and you're grasping to the title fight, and one more bad weekend, then it's all over. I personally think there's a psychological element to it. And Oscar's got that lead. He's worked hard for it because he had the big deficit, didn't he, after Melbourne. And I think it's giving him a confidence that we're barely seeing because he's always the same win or lose on the outside. But on the inside, he's a killer right now.
And it's 4-2 in terms of pole positions in Oscar's favour. 4 for Oscar, 2 for Lando. I've been hugely surprised by how Oscar has turned it around this year. Jolyon, with your racing driver hat on, what has he done that is given him that advantage? What's he done over the winter?
I mean, the change in qualifying pace is the biggest thing for him. It was 24 that he was down, and he's already got 5 on the board versus Lando. It's now 5-4 to Oscar. I think in part, Lando is not 100% comfortable with the way that the McLaren car needs to be driven this year. He's mentioned it a few times. Lando is a driver that likes to attack entry speed into the corners. I think the McLaren car now is a car with great traction, and we see them marching away on a Sunday because they've got really good ability to use the rear grip. And that's where Oscar seems to have a really good feel on the exit of the corners. And I think it's just his whole game, you know, his year 3, I think he's putting the other pieces together. His high-speed performance is really good. We saw that again in Barcelona. He was quicker than Lando in turns 3, turn 9. He was pinned quicker. But he seems to be just gelling with the car and finding the rhythm through a corner. So you're not necessarily attacking the entry speed. Sometimes Lando is much quicker on the way in, but Oscar's able to just pick his line and just get really smoothly on the throttle on the exit. And not many laps of his look, you know, like breathtaking, but the time just always comes because he's just picking up those exits, finding the speed down the straight, and seems to be working for him.
I think something that's striking me as well about Oscar is there is so much more to him than many people realise. And I feel that he hasn't changed per se. I feel like he's evolved and he's gathered experience, not just in terms of the way he goes racing, but in the way he handles himself as well. Now, this might seem like a small thing, but I really was taken aback by his sister coming to the race at the weekend and how cool she looked. You wouldn't put them together as brother and sister. And yet this is what I mean about finding out more each time about the layers to Oscar. He doesn't reveal all. He doesn't go out there on social media and say, this is who I am. As you've seen, and I don't want to name names, but there are certain young drivers that come in and they're doing all the socials and the TikToks and everything. And they're almost overexposing themselves and distracting themselves from what's going on track. Oscar's just not like that. And I'm really enjoying the process of getting to know who this kid is, who's just unbelievably quick and very methodical and just this incredible approach, but clearly also a family man who has his sis along for the ride.
I wonder if there's like 1 or 2% to his mental ability through a weekend to not worry with all of the social medias and they're being photographed in this way or making sure you're doing this TikTok or this funny dance. But I think when you're in a title fight, you don't want to be thinking about being seen here, do that, be with this brand. you're here to race in Formula One and win a championship. The sport comes first. And I like it from him. I think he's just so in the zone of extracting every bit of performance from every area, and he's nailing it.
Yeah, totally. I talked to Mark Webber about it in Monaco, and he said that Oscar just doesn't waste time or energy or mental capacity thinking about what other people think of him. It doesn't bother him. He sleeps like a baby every night. He doesn't overthink these things. And I think that is so crucial to then approaching your racing with a clear, calm mind.
It's an old school approach, isn't it? And one vaguely funny story is I walked into the McLaren motorhome in Barcelona and saw Edie, Oscar's sister, Edie and her boyfriend, chatting to Emerson Fittipaldi. And I thought they must have been friends of Emma. At the time, I didn't realise it was Oscar's sister. And until she started speaking with the Australian accent. And she was just there to soak it all up. It was her first... She'd been to Melbourne and she'd been to Singapore, but it was her first race in Europe. And there she was chatting to a two-time world champion from the 70s, just wanting to learn more about Formula One. And I just thought that said an awful lot about her, actually, and her sort of support of Oscar. So very
she's
cool.
Pass on the tips.
Yes. And JP, I'm just delighted you're not on social media. So we're getting the best from you right now on the show. This episode is sponsored by Square, your all-in-one business partner that helps keep things running smoothly no matter where you are. There's nothing more frustrating than a card machine failing when you're in a rush, especially if you're traveling and don't have many other options to fall back on. But lately, I keep spotting Square everywhere, from cafes and boutiques to food trucks and market stalls. Just last week in Spain, the restaurant where we grabbed a late dinner after recording F1 Nation was using Square. It was packed, but the staff were great, and every transaction was quick and seamless. One swift tap with my card, and we were out the door, faster than a pit stop. That's what Square does. It helps business owners stay focused on what matters most, serving their customers. Square brings everything together into one simple platform. Point of sale systems to payments, inventory, and customer tools. It's built to support your business, whether you're just starting out or scaling up. Need to go online? Square makes it easy to set up a digital store in just a few clicks. And whether your customers are paying by card, tapping their phones, or shopping online, Square handles it all. It's flexible, intuitive, and built to move with you, just like your business does. Square keeps up so you don't have to slow down. Get everything you need to run and grow your business without any long-term commitments. And why wait? Right now, you can get up to $200 off Square hardware at square.com/go/F1Nation. That's SQUARE.com/go/F1Nation. Run your business smarter with Square. Get started today. Max Verstappen is now on the brink of a race ban after his collision with George Russell in Barcelona. Not only did he receive a 10-second penalty for causing the collision, which demoted him from P5 to P10, but he was also given 3 penalty points on his license, which takes him to a total of 11, and he's now just 1 point away from an automatic race ban. 2 of those 11 points expire on the 30th of June, which is the Monday after Spielberg, so he's got to navigate the Canadian and Austrian Grand Prix before he gets a little bit more breathing room. Now, Jolyon, we asked whether Max would change his approach a few times last year after his battles with Lando Norris in Austria and Mexico in particular. It's clear then that he wasn't going to. Do you think the situation's different now?
You know, I still don't think he's going to change his approach. I still think he has one way of racing, and it is to throw everything at it and see what sticks. And a lot of the time it sticks, and it's won him some Grand Prix this year as well, when he probably otherwise wouldn't have. Imola, for example, going around the outside at the first corner. He's a driver that just gives it everything, risks more than the others probably, and I don't see it changing. I mean, the Barcelona one is obviously, it's a different scenario. That's not racing, it's... He's had red mist, hasn't he? He's lost his cool rather than misjudged a racing move. But in terms of actually what he's going to do on the track, I don't think he'll do that again. But I think I see him racing the same way, you know, still firing in lunges, still trying to hang on around the outside if he possibly can. And we'll, you know, we'll claim foul. We'll push, you know, he'll push the limits in every way.
Toto Wolff said something interesting. He said that there were common traits between Senna, Hamilton and Verstappen, and that was this sense that the world's against them. And I find it really interesting that they're able to find an extra gear in that, and they're almost able to leverage that for their own performance. So I've noticed it with Max and Red Bull. You know, it's kind of like, if you're not with us, you're against us. What I mean to say is, I think that we can stand here as fans of the sport and you as a former racer, Jolyon, and say that what he did with George was wrong. But equally, that is part of who he is and why we love him. He is exceptional. And I totally agree with Jolyon that he won't change, and neither should we want him to. I mean, apart from anything else, it made for compelling viewing. We looked at the stats on Sky F1 afterwards, and more people stuck around for the discussion at the end of that show than for any other Grand Prix, because everybody wanted to know what the pundits, former racers, current grid thought of what he did with George.
Right. There's no justification for deliberately trying to crash a Formula One car. And that's what he tried to do. You know, he tried to barge into George Russell. And I just don't see there's any justification. He is a four-time world champion. He's the best driver in the field, I still believe. And people are looking up to him as, you know, idols. How many people wear a Senna helmet or they wear a Schumacher helmet coming through the ranks? And you're looking at Carters, you're looking at young drivers, and you're thinking, is it actually okay to be a bit more Max Verstappen and to maybe deliberately drive into someone effectively? And I just don't think in a sport there's justification. I know what you mean. You know, it's a big storyline. It's getting us talking about it before Canada still. And you could argue, like, Nick Kyrgios in tennis. He's kind of, in many ways, the bad boy of tennis, isn't he? But people watch because he's entertaining and because you don't know what's going to happen next. He could be argumentative and he's a good player underneath it all. And he's got the skill to back it up. Now, Max is the next level. You know, we're talking about the best, not just one of the goods. But I mean, his racing is entertaining. I love, if you take Miami, for example, not many people would put up the, I don't know, 10, 12 lap fight he had with both McLarens. And it made for amazing viewing. Most other drivers, if you put in them in the lead of the race, the McLarens are breathing down on them. They are not throwing the Hail Mary defences, which is getting us on the edge of our seat. So it's amazing viewing. But I think you have to draw the line, at sportsmanship. And it's what I personally didn't like about Michael Schumacher growing up, because he was sometimes over the edge. And, you know, as a young Damon Hill fan, that season finale in Adelaide was controversial. Then the season finale in Jerez was even more controversial. The Raskas move was controversial. Some people love it. And you could say it's box office. I'm reeling off iconic moments from the history of sport. But is being iconic what you're trying to be? Because you're effectively just breaking the rules here and you're being unsporting and you're being a bad example at the same time. So there's a fine line, isn't there, between having these moments and actually doing the right thing.
There's definitely never any justification for driving into someone. I mean, apart from anything else, it's incredibly dangerous. But I'm also saying that he isn't going to change, and neither should we want him to, because the excellence that we see, like the overtake in Imola, we only get that if we get the full Max Verstappen, and that is the full Max Verstappen. If he goes changing, you lose those moments of brilliance as well.
But I see there's a difference between the racing Max Verstappen and that red mist moment. And I don't think I've not seen a moment like that from Max before. And again, it's like saying, you know, when Schumacher had his Raskas moment, or let's say Nico Rosberg had the Mirabeau moment. And I bet a lot of people tuned in for the debrief on those races, but it's not to say what they did was
no,
right.
I agree. It's not right, but you only get one with the other. I think if you take out the red mist element to Max's approach, you could alter him entirely.
And I also think that Red Bull were caught napping in the whole incident anyway by asking him to let him through. I don't think, had Jonathan Wheatley still been at Red Bull, they would have asked for him to let him through. And I thought it was very interesting that on lap one, Nico Hülkenberg did pretty much exactly what Max Verstappen did when he was with George Russell, went through the escape road, and Jonathan did not ask Nico to give any places back because he thought it was legit. And of course, the stewards felt the same way. So another example of Red Bull missing Jonathan Wheatley. I feel there's been a mentality shift at Red Bull in that it's always been do it, apologise later. That has always been Red Bull's mentality to going racing. And now they're apologising immediately and being a little bit more tentative. I feel there's just a shift in the way they're going about their racing.
Only on this one example, though, I think. Because you look at Jeddah just a few races ago, there was still no Jonathan Wheatley. And Max did just do it. And he took the penalty and they argued it and there was a 5 second, not a 10 second. And I think this was just one example. And maybe, you know, maybe the old Red Bull might have been a little bit more ruthless. But I don't see the, I don't necessarily see the big shift.
What do you guys feel about penalty points? Let's just discuss what happens if Max Verstappen gets one more penalty point in the next two races, is forced to miss a Grand Prix. Do you guys agree with penalty points being carried over from one season to the next?
I mean, what is the thinking behind that? Why wouldn't it just run from beginning to end of season?
Well, that to me would be a logical thing.
Yeah. So why isn't it like that?
So if you let it run from beginning and you scrub it at the end of Abu Dhabi, it's very hard for someone to do enough things from a clean slate in Melbourne to get 12 penalty points in a year. And I think, you know, this is a build-up of basically drivers breaking the rules, you know. They're getting penalties. And it's not that easy to get a ban. One driver has done it, and that's Kevin Magnussen, who, by the way, was deliberately breaking the rules last year many times. In Jeddah, he was taking the absolute piss. Same in Miami. And he knew he was, and he took it on the chin. And it helped Nico Hülkenberg get some points. He's the only driver to ever get a ban. So I don't think we've got a problem with penalty points.
But guys, why don't we just punish them at the event where they are breaking the rules? Why do we want drivers banned? They're meant to be the best drivers in the world. I don't want to see
them. So what would the punishment be then?
Well, I thought 10 seconds dropping Max from P5 to P10 at the Spanish Grand Prix was the perfect penalty. I don't think he needed penalty points on top of that.
Problem is,
I mean, it was a significant blow, wasn't it, for both his championship and the
exactly.
constructors.
Job done, dealt with. Max will have to think seriously about his approach when we go to Canada. Let's move on.
But why will he have to think seriously about his approach going to Canada if there's no carrying on disadvantage?
Because
he can do the same again and take the same penalty.
Fine, but he could get another 10-second penalty and drop down the points, and then his championship is...
In this race, a 10-second penalty hurt him. There'll be many races this year where a 10-second penalty makes a zippo difference to his finishing position. This one, because there was a late safety car, it makes a big difference. But, you know, it might be one place. And for deliberately crashing into someone, it's not a huge penalty.
So, JP, if we're not doing penalty points, let's give tougher penalties at a Grand Prix.
I think it works. I think what you don't want to see is a driver routinely breaking the rules. And I think this is enough that once you've done a few infringements, you then think, maybe I do need to just play it a little bit more fairly for a couple of races. It's only two races. And then he can go and be aggressive again. And like I say, I don't think it will change anyway. But I don't see a problem with it.
Let's extrapolate this further. I was recording a Beyond the Grid with Valtteri Bottas in Spain. We recorded it in the FIA motorhome. And as we were walking out, he bumped into the FIA sporting director, Tim Mallion, to raise the point that he is still carrying a 5-place grid penalty from the incident he had with Kevin Magnussen in Abu Dhabi at the end of last year. So if Valtteri, let's say Max Verstappen gets a ban and Christian Horner says, I tell you what, let's have Valtteri Bottas for a race. He will be starting with a 5-place grid penalty. And equally, if he gets a Cadillac ride next year, he'll go to Melbourne with a 5-place grid penalty. Does he still warrant that? Would you
change
that?
There's a level of comedy to that, isn't there? Where, you know, Valtteri turns up for his next race whenever it is, and he's got a 5-place grid penalty that no one can remember what he got it for. I mean, that is a bit ridiculous. But I don't see a problem with Valtteri's 5-place grid penalty, in my opinion, should be if he turns up to the next race. If he doesn't even do the next race, it's a 5-place penalty, whatever. You know, it's effectively he's taking a race ban, isn't he, if he doesn't turn up for whatever reason. So I don't see, that's a bit silly, it lasting over a year. And whenever he turns up, he can have 5 years off and come back and still face the music for a little crash outside of the top 10 with K-Mag.
If Verstappen gets the ban, Who would you put in that Red Bull for a race?
Well, I think Isaac Hadjar has done everything right. Whether he would want it, I mean, I'm sure he would, but whether it's the right thing for his career, I don't know. Maybe driving in that team alongside Yuki is a great moment, a great platform for him. He's not racing against Max. He's in Max's car. I mean, I'd like to see that. I think he's had a phenomenal season.
And then who would you bring in a Racing Bull?
Well, they've been trying to get special dispensation for Arvid Lindblad, haven't they? Because he's too young at the moment.
Yeah, he's 17. Turns 18 in August, yeah.
Yeah. So clearly that's their go-to guy. Again, being very impressive.
Yeah, I think you've got to put Hadjar in, haven't you? Also, Red Bull have, you know, eventually got to find someone that can drive the car. It's not Yuki. It probably won't be Isaac, but you might as well find out at some point. You know, they can't keep him in Racing Bulls forever just because he's nice and he's happy there and he's doing a great job. At some point, they have to put him into, in theory, the top team and find out what's going to happen. So they might as well.
Would you look at Bottas?
Not if he's got a 5-place grid penalty.
This episode is sponsored by Indeed. You just realised your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Join the 3.5 million employers worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent quicker than ever. Indeed's sponsored jobs ensure your listing doesn't get buried among countless others. Instead, it rises to the top of search results, reaching the most relevant candidates first. And that kind of visibility makes all the difference. In fact, data from Indeed shows that sponsored jobs posted directly on the platform receive 45% more applications compared to non-sponsored listings. And what I love about Indeed is how streamlined and efficient it makes the whole hiring process. No more lengthy subscriptions or locked-in contracts. You just pay for results. And when I say it's fast, I mean it. In the minute I've been talking to you, 23 hires were made on Indeed worldwide. There's no need to wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/nation. Just go to Indeed.com/nation right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/nation. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring, Indeed is all you need.
When you look in the mirror, you see this old school cowboy.
From the director of Top Gun Maverick.
Why did Sonny Hayes come back to F1?
Starring Brad Pitt.
Ever seen a miracle?
Pedal down.
Not yet.
On June 27th.
How do you think I'd feel if you die on the track?
Three laps. Three laps is a lifetime.
There's more to come from our preview of the Canadian Grand Prix in a moment, but I just wanted to let you know about F1's other official podcast this week. My guest on F1 Beyond the Grid is Brazil's two-time world champion, Emerson Fittipaldi. We wind the clock back 50 years and remember the 1975 Spanish Grand Prix at Montjuic Park, the race at which Emo refused to race. We also reflect on the broader strokes of his rollercoaster career at the top echelon of the sport, and Emo was in cracking form. That's out on Wednesday, and you can watch our chat on the official F1 YouTube channel. And the latest episode of F1 Explains is with Sir Jackie Stewart, who discusses the sport's greatest drivers and his ongoing work leading official F1 charity partner Race Against Dementia. That's out now. Just search for F1 Beyond the Grid and F1 Explains on your podcast app. Let's focus on the Canadian Grand Prix now. The Circuit Gilles Villeneuve is renowned for providing dramatic racing in unpredictable conditions, sensational overtakes and some remarkable stories. You've got the infamous Wall of Champions at the final chicane, which earned its nickname in 1999 after Michael Schumacher, Damon Hill and Jacques Villeneuve all crashed there And then there was Jenson Button's incredible rise from last to first in 2011. Lewis Hamilton's first Grand Prix win in 2007. Robert Kubica's emotional victory in 2008 after that horrendous crash the year before. And last year, George Russell stuck the Mercedes on pole, albeit with an identical time to Max Verstappen. And we had a three-way fight for the win between him, Lando, and eventual winner Max in a wet, dry race that even saw Charles Leclerc on hard tyres in very wet conditions. Now, Jolyon, first, let's talk about the racetrack. Why does it throw up so much drama?
I really like it as a racetrack. It's kind of a short lap, but it's bumpy. You've got to jump over the curbs, lots of chicanes. Walls obviously very close, has all the feeling of a street circuit, and it is a temporary track. But you can overtake on it, which makes it a great all-round venue, really. The run into the final chicane, you've got the Wall of Champions there on the exit. That kind of typifies Montreal. You have to bang over the curbs to be quick, but take a little bit too much, you're gonna find it biting into the barriers.
And the weather, my goodness. Can it rain in Canada? It's insane. Yeah. It's a bit like Melbourne in that respect. You get a bit of everything there weather-wise.
And we've got the return of the C6 tyre compound, the softest in Pirelli's range. Do you think Lando Norris, who was on pole in Monaco using the C6, do you think he'll take some confidence in having that tyre underneath him again?
I think he'll take confidence from the lot of it, actually. Yeah, I mean, it's as close to going back to Monaco as you can find in terms of the feel of the circuit, loads of low speed corners. You're right, the C6 is back. So it seems an odd tyre this year, where I don't even know if it's really quicker than the C5 when you see what other drivers are doing on the medium tyre in qualifying. But Lando got it talking in Monaco. And yeah, he was pretty quick there last year as well. Could have won the race were it not for the timing of the safety car there. So I think Lando will be feeling confident. You know, but we're seeing more and more this year, pole is important. It allows you to dictate the race. You can have your car in free air. You can manage your tyres that little bit more easily. If McLaren are running 1-2, then you get the better choice of strategy as well. If there's a safety car, which is not impossible in Canada, you can be the first one and not have to double stack. So qualifying is more and more important, I think, as the years go by. But at least you can overtake and race pace, and there's weather as well. There's plenty more that can play out.
And ultimately, McLaren have got confidence. They have proven they are the car for all seasons and all tracks. You know, this is finally a car that they can perform any kind of configuration, whatever the challenge is that's thrown at them. The biggest challenge they have, as we've alluded to already, is between each other. And that is what I find fascinating about the way Lando's now approaching things. His confidence, if it's in any way dented, is only because of who's across the garage from him. Nothing to do with the car. I think he's now at one with the car in a way that he didn't feel earlier in the season.
If we have a McLaren front row, JP, talk us through turns 1 and 2. It's a very slow part of the racetrack. Imagine you've got Oscar and Lando side by side going into that. Is it very easy to trip over the guy next door to you?
It's a lot easier in the front. Because when you're anywhere but basically the front three, probably, it narrows so much through the left-hander into the long right to start the lap. And it really pinches. The amount of times we see someone tripping over each other from anywhere sort of P7 to P15, there'll be someone doing a front wing around turn two. Out front, it's more easy to control. You can pick your line. There's space to run side by side if you have to. And it'll be about trying to make sure you get the inside for the right-hander in the end, because that's the crucial part. It's a long way round from the outside. And if you have the inside there, you have the inside for turns 3 and then 4, the little chicane after it. So that's the key. And again, it's not a massive run to the first corner as well. So pole, once again, is a sizable advantage there. It's not like Barcelona.
What about Red Bull then? Max is going for his fourth win in a row in Montreal. I remember going into the race last year, people saying, oh, the Red Bull doesn't like the chicanes. clearly was fine over the chicanes. He's on the back foot after everything that went on in Barcelona. But from a performance point of view, do you think he can sneak a pole and a win?
Is he on the back foot, though? I feel that actually when the pressure's on Max, he delivers above and beyond. I think if anything, he'll harness what happened in Barcelona and use it to his advantage in Canada.
he's good on the back foot, isn't he? It's his favourite position to be in, I think, sometimes, just taking shots and then firing them back straight away with a with a massive comeback drive. It's very doable.
And do you think the RB21 will perform, though, around Montreal?
Logically, I don't think it'll be a circuit they're looking forward to. I think, you know, it is a lot of low-speed corners. That car is much better at high speed. I don't think it's one that will be kind to them again. Curb riding, bumps, it's not been good. But as you said, last year you would have said exactly the same things and he still equaled the pole time and won the race. So even in Monaco, he was in the contention until right at the end of it. You never thought he was not going to be right there in the mix, but just didn't quite get Q3. And the car was probably missing a tenth or two, but they can find that quite easily. And it'll be there or thereabouts, but I don't think it'll be one of their favoured tracks.
Interestingly as well, TC, I do think that Red Bull are being challenged in different ways, as is he being the underdog to McLaren this season. So when you think about Monaco, they were stretching it right out in the hope of a late safety car and responding well to that. In Barcelona, they went for a bold strategy. They're just being challenged in slightly different ways and asking extra questions of themselves. And I'm finding it interesting to watch how they respond to this new territory, if you like.
I still think strategically they are the strongest team. The three-stopper in Barcelona was a really good move for them. And it was actually just unlucky having a safety car at the end when they had no more decent tyres to use. I think they were sort of snookered either way. And you're right, the Monaco one, it was a really clever strategy to stay out and kind of hope for a red flag at the end that would have changed the race. I still think, with the weather, with safety cars, it literally like it was last year, you definitely wouldn't rule them out.
Well, you said it might not be a track that Red Bull are looking forward to, JP. Well, what about Ferrari? Remember last year, Charles Leclerc dominated Monaco and then 2 weeks later, they go to Montreal and I think, what, Leclerc qualified 11th with Sainz 12th. Neither of them in Q3. Is there reason to believe that Leclerc and Hamilton will go better this year?
They can't go worse than that, can they? I think that's the good thing for them. It was as bad as could be. Again, on paper, it's a good track for Ferrari. The corners are basically all low speed, which is what allowed the car to work in Monaco. They didn't have to worry about any sort of high speed setup. They could just run the car low to the ground and get it working. But again, they obviously flopped last year. They did completely mess up their qualifying strategy. They not run on slicks when it was dry and then put them on when it was too wet in Q2. And then the race was a bit of a mess from there. So I don't think it was a pure illustration of the performance, but they were disappointing. I think, again, if you're Ferrari now, you're thinking this is as good a shot as any. And also, Hamilton is brilliant in Montreal generally. So this has got to be some sort of redemption circuit for Lewis, I think.
Well, 7 wins, 6 poles for Lewis. Do you understand his struggles, either of you, this year, in that qualifying is a problem, as it was at Mercedes last year, and then we get these moments of brilliance almost in every race now, but only moments? When is he going to start putting these moments together to create more than just a moment and actually a good Grand Prix weekend?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I've ever seen him, well, I mean, I have over the last 14 years, but not in recent memory, so low as he was in the pen in Monaco and then the pen in Barcelona. He was completely dejected. He had more questions than answers and, you know, a lot of soul searching required. But as you say, we have seen these moments of brilliance in the Lewis of old. So we know it's still there. He just needs the stars to be aligned to deliver it. And that's not happening frequently enough for him.
Honestly, I can't think what these moments of brilliance are that we've seen this year. Obviously,
well,
China.
Sprint win in China.
Yeah. So China and the sprint quali in China as well, to do it over one lap was impressive. So China, definitely. Other than that,
JP, I'm talking about there have been stints in races where you suddenly find yourself looking at his lap times and going, hang on a minute, he's now at a front-running pace.
Yeah.
And so, that's come from nowhere.
Yeah, and he has been, occasionally it looks like he can find his groove. And there's also been parts through a weekend where he's matching Charles pretty well and you're thinking they're within a tenth either way. Even Monaco, Charles was on the front row, but for a lot of the weekend, it didn't look like Lewis was miles away from him. And then he had the crash and didn't quite get there in qualifying. But I don't know. I still just think, to me, he's up against a prodigious talent in Charles Leclerc. And I think Leclerc is going to be right up there with Max in terms of one-lap performance. And we've seen it for years. Some of his pole-ups have been exquisite. And trying to match up to that is difficult. And I also think Leclerc's race pace is really underrated. When you see what he's done for a few years now, you remember sort of the Ferrari from 5 years ago when they were just eating through their tyres. But that was more about the car than the drivers. And I think sometimes in our minds, we can tarnish kind of Charles with a little bit of, yeah, but his race pace isn't there. Actually, when you look through the last few years, some of his race drives have been amazing. And the car's sometimes not quite been there. It was a bit last year. But in previous years, the car's been not great, but it's somehow hauled it back up towards a top five or maybe a podium. And I think that's where Lewis is at. You know, he's coming into Charles' team. He's adored there, Leclerc. And he's just a tough person to be up against on the other side of the garage.
Now, who would have thought Racing Bulls would outscore Mercedes in that first European triple header? Because that is what happened. And if you judge it on the opening races of the year when George Russell was banging in the podiums, it came as a surprise to us and I think the team as well. Where do they go? I mean, George Russell started the Canadian Grand Prix last year from pole. He finished on the podium. Can they hope for something similar?
I think the biggest surprise for me has actually been the reliability issues. You touched on it earlier, like we weren't expecting a safety car at the end of Barcelona because we certainly weren't expecting Antonelli, the power unit, to go pop. And I think that will be a bigger concern than anything else at the moment because the talent is there and the performance has been there throughout the season so far. But these, you know, these little gremlins must be worrying them.
And Alonso had the failure in Monaco as well, didn't he? So
yeah,
two races in a row, we've seen a Mercedes PU let go. What about the performance of the car itself, JP?
I mean, I think in terms of qualifying pace, they're still really competitive. If you look at what George did in Spain, it was very good. And then he didn't get the start. And actually, even his race pace wasn't as terrible as Mercedes were fearing it might be. I think they'll be competitive in Canada. They were on pole last year. They're still temperature sensitive. I think as the season's going on, we're kind of realizing that the hotter it is, the worse they are. But particularly on a Sunday now, where they're just not able to look after their tyres, it does mean that they're firing them up quite well. And I think Canada's a pretty non-abrasive circuit. That's why we're on the softest end of the tyre range. I think they will fire those tyres up. I think George will be pretty strong as he was last season. I can see it being their best race of the year and the deg is low, so it's a good chance for them to hang in there on Sunday as well.
If Mercedes have had a tough run in Spain, let's talk about Williams because, I mean, crikey, both drivers were driving wounded in that Grand Prix. Alex Albon gets a 10-second penalty himself. We've talked enough about 10-second penalties from that race already in this pod, but do Williams understand what their issues were in Spain and will they recur in Montreal?
They were downbeat before Spain. I think they knew that it was going to be a difficult circuit. It's long corners that their car's never been good at. Long, fast corners, putting their aero parts through various different phases of a corner that just goes on and on. It's not good for them. They like short, sharp stuff. It can be high or low speed, but they like to be through a corner and back out. So I think, again, they should be back to much better Williams form in Canada. I think they'll be back up in the top 10 in qualifying. When we spoke already about the technical directive, and I said the pecking order hadn't shifted, well, Williams were the obvious outlier that had been right up there with even with Ferrari and Mercedes before, and then suddenly were nowhere. So they kind of need a performance on a track that on paper is much better for them. Otherwise, you could start to think, well, maybe they've lost a little bit with this technical directive. But I do think it was circuit specific for them in Spain.
Well, Carlos Sainz said in the press conference on the Thursday of Spain, he said, yeah, I don't think it'll, you know, you might lose a tenth or two. And I had to interrupt and say a tenth or two is about four places on the grid this year. And he went, oh yeah, that's true.
Oh dear, shouldn't have said that.
Yeah, and that is exactly what we saw from them, wasn't it? But look, if they're the hard luck story of Spain, just a quick mention in dispatches for Sauber. I mean, they had the new floor, the new front wing, the new airbox, engine cover, and my goodness, they really did make a step forward, didn't they? It wasn't...
I mean, can you imagine if Nico Hülkenberg actually gets that elusive first podium in Formula One in a Sauber? Can you imagine? It could happen.
But Jolyon, you wouldn't have been surprised, would you? Because I remember when we did a Beyond the Grid together, you described Nico as the career killer.
Yeah.
Oh, JP, don't.
Well, that's why I'm here talking to you guys. Yeah. What a pleasure.
There's always a silver lining.
Yeah, I think he's seriously talented. I have so much respect for Gabriel Bortoleto because I'm amazed that his qualifying pace has been right there or even ahead of Nico as often as it has been. So fair play to Gabriel for that. But I still think on a Sunday we're seeing Nico extracting some really good lap times. Race pace has been good. And the Spanish Grand Prix, you know, he's basically had two chances to score points this year. One was Melbourne and he came through in seventh, and then Spain, and suddenly he's fifth by the end. I mean, it was a remarkable series of events that got him there, but basically the car was much better and the team executed the race pretty much perfectly.
And Jonathan Wheatley said on this show last week, we have a proper race car now, and I'm quoting him. So let's hope Sauber can be there or thereabouts going forward. If Barcelona's got long corners, then I'm looking forward to seeing what Sauber can do, you know, at Silverstone, for example, in a couple of races' time. I think we should see them back in the points.
I'm actually so interested as well in the trajectory of Jonathan Wheatley's career, having finally sort of come out of the shadow of Christian Horner to blossom into this team leadership role. And I think you're right, JP, various things did happen, but I think all under the stewardship of Jonathan Wheatley. It's interesting how much of an impact he can have at the team and, you know, in terms of performance for their car.
Fastest pit stop in Spain. Sauber.
There you go.
That's how you put together a P5. It's not, you know, everything has to be bang on for him to be doing that. And the pits up, the strategy, the tyre choice and the driving, it was all very good. And they need it, don't they? Because they're becoming Audi. You know, they want a bit of fanfare when they become Audi. The Audi are not coming in to muck around at the back. So I feel like Sauber need to start showing that they can at least be a fighting car for some points and not just making up the numbers this year.
You need momentum. It's something that Alonso has said about Aston Martin. We said, yes, it's all about 2026 for us, but we need to start building some momentum this year because it takes a while to get used to fighting at the sharp end of the grid, right? You can't just parachute in and expect to be as good as McLaren in race one, even if you have a car as good as the McLaren. It's all about, as you say, the pit stops and making the right decisions and all those sorts of things as well. And look, I'm talking about Alonso. Wasn't it good to see him get his first points of the season in Spain on home turf? A run of three consecutive appearances in Q3 for him. Aston are a team on the move, it feels.
What's going on with Lance, though?
Well, I can give you an update. The team have told me that to expect situation normal in Montreal, i.e. Lance Stroll will be partnering Fernando Alonso at the Canadian Grand Prix. He had a small operation on his wrist on the Monday after the Spanish Grand Prix, and it's just a question of recovering.
And that was a hangover from his 2023 crash?
Yeah, the cycling crash he had during the off-season in 2023.
I definitely don't want to compare myself to a Formula One driver, but when I was 8, I broke both my arms twice at the same time. So I was like this in plaster for 8 weeks. The listeners cannot see what I'm doing, but I'm sticking my hands out and they are not moving at all. There is no flexi wing here. 25 years later, I was doing kettlebells in the garden and then this little bit of bone off my wrist just popped out. So you can have hangovers from long-term injuries. And I had to have another operation 25 years later.
And how long did it take you to get over that second operation 25
years
later?
I mean, I was nails. I was back out there within 2 days.
Right, so Lance Stroll can be back out there within two days this time around. Okay,
we've already seen this superhuman comeback from him when he went racing again last time. And do you remember you and I bumped into him in the paddock? And you could tell it was almost like a therapy session. He needed to release all the angst and tension that he'd been building up and tell us blow by blow what he'd been through since the operation.
It was the most open Lance Stroll has ever been. Do you remember? It was like, hang on. I remember us looking at each other going, we can't shut him up. He just wanted to keep talking. And as you say, it felt like a therapy session.
Yeah. Well, it was a Herculean effort then. And so expect more of the same this time around. But just interesting that he was able to take part in quali and then not the race. And a shame for the team because, you know, Lonzo was able to put it in the points. They need all the points they can get right now. They needed a second car in that race.
I thought it was a shame that his decision to not race came after qualifying. They've got very competent reserve drivers. Felipe Drugovich is a former F2 champ that's trying to get a shot at Formula One. Then for the team, it would have been better for them to just put another car in the Grand Prix. An F2 champ gets the chance to show what he can do. You know, when you've got Fernando trying to do his best up in the top 10, you at least want to see what a hard tyre can do, or what a medium tyre, or evaluate what a reserve driver can do. And I don't know, the timing of it, I thought, was not good for Aston Martin, the team. And it's just such a shame to see you've got all the team are turning up. 50% of that team are working on Fernando's car. 50% are working on Lance's car. This is the end of a triple header. They're all knackered. They're exhausted. They've just come from Monaco. It's a busy period of the season. They turn up to Spain, bolt the car together. The car is actually really competitive, as we saw from Fernando. He went through the gravel and still managed to score some points in it. It was really good. And he's qualifying. He's on fire at the moment. But half the team have done all this work and they haven't even got a car in the race. You know, it's pretty difficult to have that, I can imagine, as a mechanic, and you're up in the, you know, grinding it out, and you're not even taking part for that. You just think, at least get a reserve driver. You've got a really competent reserve driver. At least, if it's possible, get him to drive, and you have a chance if something's on. Or you can pass those learnings on to Fernando on the other side and give him a better chance of scoring points.
So what do you do if you're Aston Martin this weekend in Canada? Do you take Drugovich with you because you're concerned that the same might happen and that Lance will be in pain? Do you get him to sacrifice a drive at Le Mans? Or do you say, no, Drugovich, you go and race at Le Mans, and if we have a problem with Lance, we'll get on the phone to someone like Valtteri Bottas with his 5-place grid penalty?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. No one wants him for a one-off. It's a tricky one for them, though. But they need Lance to just be honest, don't they? And Canada's also a difficult circuit because you've got all the bumps, and if you've just had an operation on your wrist, then you've got to be sort of having all those vibrations over the curbs. You've got walls that are really, really close, and you could easily snag, and it can just jar the steering wheel. So I think it just needs to be an honest assessment from Lance. It's also his home race, though, so
I know,
he's going to be desperate to be back.
He will take a very painful risk to keep him out of that race. And I know about painful wrists.
25 years later, Pinks, we're still hearing
later.
About it. Guys, what a chat. Thank you both very, very much for your time. Can we end this the traditional way and put our podium predictions down? JP, who are you saying?
I think this is a Norris victory. And I'm going to say, second place, George Russell. Third is going to be, it's got to be Oscar still. I don't see him being off the podium.
I'm going to go Lando, Max, Lewis.
Oh, tasty. Lewis Hamilton. First Grand Prix podium for Ferrari at the track where he scored his first win. I like that. I like the romance of that.
You know me, TC, romantic old thing.
Now back to reality. I'm going Norris, Piastri, Russell myself. We discuss what we learnt from the triple header and whether Max Verstappen will change his approach going forward. So now it's time to find out what we learned about our F1 fantasy team during the triple header and whether we should change our approach for Canada. Well, we didn't learn very much other than the fact that we're still not very good. We managed to get just over 200 points in Spain, but that's as good as it got over the three races. As for our approach in Canada, both Jolyon and Pinks think Lando Norris will win the race, but we can't afford to swap him in for Oscar Piastri. And actually, both Jolyon and I predict a 9th consecutive podium for Oscar this weekend. So let's keep the Aussie in. We've also replaced Franco Colapinto with Fernando Alonso because I think the 2-time world champion will go on a run now he's finally got his first points of the season. So that's a lineup of Piastri, Alonso, Alex Albon, Nico Hülkenberg and Isaac Hadjar, with McLaren and Williams as our constructors. So wish us luck, fingers crossed. F1 Fantasy is free to play. Just go to f1.com or the official F1 app to create your team, and you can compete against us and other listeners by joining the 2025 F1 Nation World Championship. And remember, you have until the start of qualifying for the Canadian Grand Prix to make any changes to your team. Good luck! Guys, thank you very much for your time. Am I going to be seeing either of you in Montreal?
Not going to be seeing me.
You're going to be changing nappies.
Knee-deep in nappies. No, my next race is Austria, and then it's a run of Silverstone, Hungary, Spa. So I'm not in Canada.
Well, Pinks, look forward to seeing you at those races. And JP, good luck with the birth of your child. And see you both again soon.
Cheers, TC. See you soon.
Can't wait.
Now, you can keep across the action in Canada this weekend via F1.com and the official F1 app. And in selected countries, you can watch all the racing on F1 TV. And don't forget as well that F1, the movie starring Brad Pitt, is out in cinemas this month. Go to F1themovie.com to book your tickets. Thank you very much for listening. We will, of course, be back on Monday from the Montreal paddock with our review of the Canadian Grand Prix. F1 Nation is produced by Formula One and Audio Boom Studios.